Welcome to Jewish History with Rabbi David Katz, connecting the human side to Jewish history. For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidavidkatz.com.
Hi. I promised to do this other podcast, and I was thinking about it. This is like a request performance, and I'll tell you why I decided to do so. I have a friend, Mrs. Friedman, Lolly Friedman, and she mentioned to me that this week is the yahrzeit of her grandfather, I guess, and she's great-granddaughter of Aryeh Levin, the famous Tzaddik of Yerushalayim. Perhaps I have to always remind myself that a lot of people listening to these are not necessarily older people. I run into a lot of teens. Ran into a guy yesterday from Beth Israel or whatever. And a lot of names and things that I take for granted, people will not necessarily know. For those of you who are younger, perhaps, you go and Google Rabbi Aryeh Levin, and or better yet, get the book, which is out there all over the place, called Tzaddik in Our Time. And you'll find a very good, I guess, biography or something like that, stories of a very unusual person. Yerushalayim died in 69 and was very active in the first half of the 20th century. And the person I want to speak about today was his son, Rechaim Yaakov Levin, which would be Lolly's grandfather, who, as I'm reviewing what she and I learned together, because there was an article in the Yeshua magazine that I did together with her, her request, like a biographical article, and it was like a Forrest Gump story. That's the reason that I'm attracted to it, and I'll explain what I mean as I go along. But once again, for those of you, especially younger people out there, you maybe you've heard of, maybe haven't, for Aryeh Levin, that's a name you want to check out. Let me say this. Many years ago in Baltimore, used to have something called the Baltimore Hebrew College. The Baltimore Hebrew College, which was a secular Jewish institution for teacher training and that sort of thing. In Chachmat Yisrael, but you don't know what that means. And, you know, in Jewish studies, let's say. And they had a very big library, and nobody ever used it, so therefore it was my private library. And I had a great deal of benefit from it over many years. And because I used to go there, and there was nobody there. So you have like 50,000 volumes, I don't know what they had over there, and magazines and, you know, journals and whatever. And Bishvili Nivra Olam. It's very interesting. I really regret the fact that the Associated Jewish Charities in Baltimore decided literally to tear the place down and turn it into a parking lot. That is literally what happens. Which shows you that Jewish culture has crashed in the non-from sector of American Judaism. They have no respect for culture anymore. That's why you have an abominable ignorance and that sort of thing going on now. I'm not speaking about observance of mitzvahs and that sort of thing. I'm talking about Jewish knowledge. Now, having said that, long ago, I'm talking 40-some years ago, I once was in the Hebrew College, going around looking for something. And this is a secular library, so they have all kinds of swarm there. They certainly do. Rabbi, what's the name you used to go there all the time? The Hasidic Rebbe, Sternhill. He's the only other one I ever saw there, Rabbi Rottenberg. He didn't see too many other people there. And they weren't there for the non-from books. They were there for the rare swarm. But usually, you know, most of the books there are what you would call non-Torah literature. So, very valuable, but non-Torah literature. And I remember long, long ago, I mean, I'm talking in the mid-70s or something like this, before my sister was married. She got married in 79, so I'll tell you why I say this. I once walked in, and as I'm walking by the long shelves, rows of shelves, I see there's this book with a smiling rabbi with a great beard on it or something like that. Somehow it didn't fit in, you know? And I figured, what is this? What the heck is this? And I picked up, it's called Tzaddik in Our Time. This one, more or less, when the book came out. And I figured, oh, yeah, yeah, one of these, you know, hagiographical books, or something like that. Meaning, it's not going to be, they're all the same. You know, the person was a genius since he was a baby, it was a tzaddik, and all that stuff. But I opened a page just for the heck of it, and then I opened another page and another page, and I couldn't stop reading it. And so I said, I took the book out. And I brought it home. This is the story of Rabbi Aryeh Levin. And
So I remember very clearly, I lived at that time, like I say, it was myself, my mother, my sister, as my father passed away. So we're talking about in the late 70s. And I came home. I remember distinctly it was a Thursday night. And I said, boy, I got this most unusual book from the Hebrew College. And my mother and my sister took a hold of it. And my mother said, let me just see it. Next thing I know, it's gone. Don't see it for a week. Then my sister got it. It's gone for a week. And then I had to give it back. Had to take it out again. Had that nature to it. And Rabbi Levin was a big tzaddik, but the stories are not the normal stories. That's what I'm trying to say. He was big in Eretz Yisrael, with it being the I can't even generalize on this. The rabbi of the prisoners, he went to visit the jails, and was involved with the Irgun guys in the 40s, and a superlative tzaddik, and this person give you a shirt off the back and live the life of great poverty on purpose. And, you know, helped everybody. It was makar of a lot of people for Judaism. I'm not doing justice to it. You'll have to go and read it yourself. That would be a podcast by itself and probably a long one. So, anyway, for those of you know I'm talking about, I don't have to explain. And for the younger ones, I advise you to go and get that book. Now, so Mrs. Lolly Friedman, who is, I say, the great-granddaughter of Davari Levin, so she said, came to me a year ago, 2 years ago, whatever, with this big, fat volume of the Yeshurun, which is the premier Torah journal now, that comes out once or twice a year. And they had a whole section about her grandfather, and they're including a biographical section. I should go over with her. And I said, fine. We're friends. And I figured, you know, just be a biography. And then we read on and on and on. And the interesting part was, like I said, it's a Forrest Gump. He knew everybody, he met everybody. It's like a walking, tour of the, I guess, the first half of the 20th century. And therefore, it deserves a mention in terms of what I can say today. Although I didn't know him, and I didn't know that much about him, but probably more than you and outside the family. So with those weird introductory remarks, I begin. If you're looking... We're talking over here, Yerushalayim, long ago, to put a geographical, a chronological spin on this. Rav Aryeh Levin was this Jew in Lithuania and White Russia, who was born in 1885 and died in 1969. So that means he was in his 80s when he passed away, right? In mid-80s. And he met, and you know, from... obviously, and he learned in some of the yeshivas in Lithuania. And then the interesting thing is in 1905, so I guess that would be when he's 20 years old, when he get not to be in the Russian army, so he made Aliyah, which is very unusual in those days. This is before the First World War. So he's real from real tzaddik. And he moved to Yerushalayim, and he got smicha there from Rav Kook. Here's the interesting part of the story, as far as I'm concerned. This is the old, real Yerushalmi elites, the Litvish elites, in which politics wasn't that big of a deal. I know to the American, they'll say right away, is it Aguda, is it the Mizrahi, is it this group, is it that group? This can drive you crazy. If you read the story about Rav Aryeh Levin and his family and others, it's beyond that. You know, it can drive you crazy. It's a little bit like the Shaduchim world. When I was young, they didn't say like this. Is the mother green? Is she purple? What color is the dress? Now they got to know, you know, what exactly Shiva was it in? What kind of tablecloths they have? Would you call this person modern? What do you call it? Does he have a black hat? Does he tilt that to the left or right? You know, all those questions that they find in the Shadchan now that they try to box everybody in. What do you do to the people that don't want to be in a box? What do you do about that? They don't know what. They don't know how to handle it. So the world is taken over by math and science weirdos. They've dominated the culture. That's the culture in which we live in now, can I tell you? Now, Rav Aryeh Levin, therefore, came to Yerushalayim. He got a job there from Rav Kook. Rav Kook had just moved to Israel in Yafo, if you know where he was at the very beginning, Rav Kook. And he met Rav Aryeh Levin, and they became very close. And this has nothing to do with politics. And he actually helped him move to Yerushalayim. And the Rav Aryeh Levin got married there to his wife, who obviously was a tzedekah, so she's willing to live that life of great esteemiousness and doing without in order to help others and do chesed all the time. I won't go into the yichas over there because that'll take too long. But anyway, he got married there,
And he raised a family, including this Chaim Yaakov. So here's somebody born in Yerushalayim before the First World War in 1911. There was quite a Jewish community at that time. Of course, it's before the British and everything took over. And this is the old Yerushalayim and Mea Shearim and all that sort of thing. And so you already had the city divided into from and not from. But the not from hadn't really taken off in a big way. And the from world was divided into, I say, the Litvish and the Hasidish, more or less. And, you know, you had the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva and all those institutions in which they had equivalent of what you have now. In other words, you have a Talmud Torah, Yeshiva Katana, Yeshiva Gedola, and all the rest of it for the smaller from community of that time. And anybody who's from a Mood Yerushalayim at that time is already self-selected. Get it? Hear what I just said? It's not big aliyah. So this one moves here, that one moves here. They're obviously self-directed to be different than most others and have a teshuka to want to live in Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, and suck up the Kedusha and the Torah and all the rest of it. And these are people who want to be Talmidei Chachamim. So it's going to be a life of Torah and Eretz Yisrael. So that's who our hero is. Now, here goes the story. So this young guy's born in 1911, so put those years together. So he's growing up, I guess, during the First World War, right? Which broke out in 1914. The First World War ended in 1918. I don't know if you know anything at all. You probably don't. First World War was really tough in Eretz Yisrael and Yerushalayim because it was a starvation. Besides everything else, the Turks were in charge. It was up to the Turks. They would kill all the Jews there, but they were allied to Germany and Austria. And Germany and Austria at that time, believe it or not, wouldn't let the Turks kill all the Jews. So it was a precarious existence. And food, forget it. And times were very tough. But whoever, and many died, and whoever didn't die, didn't die. Now, that puts you at a young boy growing up in these tumultuous years and going to Cheder, where his father is like what became the Mashkiach or something like that of the young boys. And here's the part I like. Like I said before, this is like a Forrest Gump. Who's this Chavrusa in, you know, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, all the rest of it? Well, this boy, Chaim Yaakov Levin, turned out to be an Eloi. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an interesting story. So he's a genius. And has a memory, you know, can memorize, photographic memory, and then, you know, memorize all the Tosas and all the rest of it. And his Chavrusa, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who's a young boy. And what I like is, here's a real story from yesteryear. They're in this cheder of old, you know, back in Yerushalayim. And he skips a grade because he was that smart. Well, guess what? The other kids don't like a smarty pants that kids are great. Even if you're super from in Yerushalayim in 1918 or 1920 or whatever, and everything's supposed to be saturated Torah year, boys are boys. And who is this guy that, you know, dares to be in our class even though he's a year younger? And when he gets bar mitzvah, all the boys boycott him. You hear what I'm saying? No, because they all jointly together. Okay, it sounds like girls, doesn't it? He says, they all say we're not going to come to the bar mitzvah. If he has a bar mitzvah, none of his classmates show up. Isn't that a story? None of his classmates show up because they're angry at him. Except one, and the one is, of course, the Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And that's one of those stories of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And he says, I'll bring you a present. So this is just a chevra in which he's hanging out. Now, Yerushalayim becomes very interesting after the First World War because that's the British mandate. And for 30 years, from 1918 to 1948, right, the British were ruling Palestine. And from a broad point of view, it's very complicated because they wouldn't let a lot of Jews into Palestine. On the other hand, from a narrow point of view, if you were Jewish living in Yerushalayim, the British years, to be perfectly honest, were good years because the British kept law and order. They did. And they allowed Judaism to practice itself, you know, unbothered. And so Torah and the yeshivas could grow as much as the internal dynamics of the Jewish community would grow. You can't blame it on the British. The only thing is, of course, you had the rise of secular Zionism, and they kind of took over and offered a competing culture. You really had a culture conference, they call it, culture battle, which kind of Jewish culture should be the predominant one. The Haredim obviously wanted theirs to the exclusion of everything else. The new Chilonim wanted theirs pretty much to the exclusion of everything else. So the Haredim would have, you know, the traditional yeshivas of Mea Shearim and that sort of thing. And outside of Mea Shearim, and the Chilinuin have the gymnasium and then eventually the Hebrew University. These are two alternative tracks that are developing. It's very interesting in Yerushalayim in the years of the mandate. And here's Rabbi Levin, who's teaching the boys and has this genius son who's growing up. You can see already, you know, he gets bechinas. That's why I say, you name it, you name the big famous rabbi. He lived in Israel, and he gave this boy bechina, and, you know, he passed a pin test and all the rest of it. And he meets everybody along the way, becomes a student of Mr. Zalman Meltzer, because he's brought in from Europe to run the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, the older branch. And Bar Ilan, Mayor Bar Ilan, the Mizrahi leader, gives him a test, and he can pass the, what do you call it, the pin test, and all that sort of thing. And so here's a young guy growing up, probably being the best in the cheder, then the best in the yeshiva, the best student of Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, who then says, by the end of the 20s, you know, you can do better than here. See, that's the funny thing. At that time, you think, what's higher than Yerushalayim? What's more Kaddish than Yerushalayim? Well, it depends who you are. From a very mystical point of view, and even the Hasidic point of view, it doesn't get better in Yerushalayim. I mean, many, many points of view. But if you're actually the governor of Jerusalem in the 1920s was a British guy, Sir Ronald Storrs, who wrote a famous autobiography called There Are No Promotions After Jerusalem. Because even though he became a governor of Canada and Africa, he's about the years in Yerushalayim with the peak, you know, just have this chus. And he wasn't Jewish. So from many points of view, Yerushalayim is number one. But not if you're Litvish. If you're Litvish, this is just interesting to me. The highest place in the world is where the most advanced learning is going on. And this is all Melissa. So he goes, go back to Lithuania, to Europe, and learn by Baruch Bear. So this is weird. Here's a guy growing up in Eloy, at least to me, living in Yerushalayim. But they say, if you want to really learn how to learn, you know, the super longest, then go to the biggest, you know, learner of the day and go to Kamenetz. Kamenetz is in Poland, but it's the part of Poland that used to be Lithuania. And he goes and learns by him for a year or two. And then I tell you, he's far as gone. And then Baruch Bear sends him to learn and talk and learning with Briskarov. So he's like touching all the bases over here. And meanwhile, all during these years, Rav Kook made his business to be close with him and talk to him always in learning. Because, you know, who doesn't like the young Eloy if the Eloy has good minos? This is always the problem. In Judaism, we have two types, at least, I think, we have two types of Eloys. You have the Eloy who's an Eloy and knows it, and it's not so easy to be around. That's number one. And then you have the Eloy, it's much more rare, that it's a nice guy. Yes, he's very nice. And he doesn't mind learning with somebody less than him and give you the time of day. And it's very just good mitos. And being the son of Ari Levin, you're going to have both. So who's not going to like him? And therefore, Rav Kook, and then Rav Herzog comes to Israel. And these are the ones that give him the smicha. By the way, his mother's sister was married to Tzvi Pesach Frank, who was the Rav Rashi Yerushalayim. So he gave him the smicha. So I told you, he's like plugged in with everybody. If you read this article, you're going to come across everybody along the way. Now, this puts you in the 1930s. Here's a young man about 20. And Rav Kook tells him, since you're such a Eloy, and you're bucking Kachem, right, a Sefer in Kachem, and he puts out, like, age of 20 or something like this. Apparently, he's very hush of a Sefer that I never heard about. Because that's the fate of the 20th century. There are a ton of big learners. This I happen to know. There are a bunch of big learners, and they know a Welt. But you want to know something? The Welt wasn't holding by that in those years. This is the tragedy of the rabbinate of the, let's say, the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, into the 80s. And that is, you know, the Baal HaBatim can appreciate what the person has. I strongly suspect that Rabbi Chaim Yaakov probably was like that. It's clear to me from what I'm reading that he knew everything by heart, and he was big, you know, all the svaras and the alumdus and all the rest of it. Where do you exactly have a community, I mean, a synagogue or a community out there in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, which is the years of his life, right? Who can appreciate somebody like that? Not in America. You see, you and I live in times, things have changed. The yeshivas in Israel and America have now turned out entire generations of Baal HaBatim.
You go to shuls in Baltimore and elsewhere, maybe I'm prejudiced called the Baltimore, and Israel certainly like that, in which you have row and row out of Balabatim, who aren't rabbis, and they're not, you know, rebbes and yeshivas or anything like this, but they've gone through yeshivas. And A, they have an appreciation for learning, and B, some of them know how to learn. I mean, seriously. And so we have in Baltimore and elsewhere, you know, synagogues, which have many people that understand learning. And somebody like that can appreciate a Rav who's a Gon Adir. But if you're talking about 50 years ago, 70 years ago, yeah, I can't really see it. I hope I'm wrong, but I can't really see it. Not as I recall from my distant youth. And here's Rabbi Levin. You're now, 20, 25 years old. He got married in the 30s to a girl from London. And now what do you do? So in an ideal world, an existing yeshiva would give him a job in an ideal world. Because clearly somebody like this was top level and would be an excellent magashir or something like that. Well, guess what? There are very few yeshivas in the 1930s, and they're all, you know, every job is closely guarded. You understand? That's like it's a family business. Every job is closely guarded. And the few positions that are out there, somebody's lucky enough to get them, but it's rare. There are very few yeshivas. For example, in the United States of America, at the time he got married in the 1930s, he had YU. What else do you have? You have Torah Das. You know, and one or two small other places, you know, that's it, whatever, you know, very small. It's not what you think. It's not what it was later. Near Israel was tiny, MTJ, you know, with nothing. You know, it's a Skokie out there. It's a little bit, but not much. And this is a tough world of yesteryear. You have to, you know, grow up and live in the right time and place, as they say. And so Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Levin actually come, right, what it said was like this. Mayor Bar-Ilan, who was the head of the Mizrahi and knew everything. It was a nice person. He was a good friend of Rabbi Ruderman, by the way. I'm talking about the son of the Netziv, the one who founded the Mizrahi party. He said, I guess, go to America. It's like when the Second World War breaks out. And you'll be able to get a job there, maybe in YU or something like this. Well, he came to America, there was no job. And what do you do? And I don't know exactly how it happened, but and I know there's some people listening to this podcast from Seattle, so they'll be able to send me the information. But somewhere or other, he crossed America and went over to Seattle to start a yeshiva there, you know, like in the late 30s, around 1940 or so. Hear what I said? To start a yeshiva in Seattle, Washington. Now, I'll tell you the truth, I've been there a few times, and it's a beautiful area, and I can see there was a community yesteryear. My very kind host and driver, Eli Ganauer, is probably listening, has drove me around quote-unquote old Jewish Seattle. Like, I'm doing old Jewish Baltimore on Sunday. He knows, does he know old Jewish Seattle. We went to Rabbi Shapiro's old shul and things. And I don't know what shul Rabbi Levin was, but he came there to try to make a yeshiva. Now, by the way, it might have worked. I wasn't there. It's just as a historian, it'd be very interesting to see what were the chances of Seattle taking off. Because that's what Rabbi Ruderman did in Baltimore. The only difference is Baltimore had like 80, 90,000 Jews, and Seattle probably had 10, 20. So it's not so simple. And as happens, the yeshiva didn't happen, but he became a rabbi there for sure. And this is just very interesting, because to set up a yeshiva back in those days was an avodas perach. As much easier to be a rabbi. Plus, a lot of people wanted to be rabbis. If you're a good speaker, and you get a decent congregation, whatever. I myself knew one or two people years ago, I won't say any names, here in Baltimore, that they were perfect for Maggid Shir. In fact, they were offered in big yeshivas Maggid Shir job, which today somebody was considered at the top of the pile, and said they want to be rabbis of shuls, which makes no sense, but that's was America in those years. It's an interesting question I'm raising. Would you ask somebody, would you rather be a Rosh Yeshiva or a Maggid Shir, like a Rabbi Kalevsky type of that sort? Would you rather be a rabbi of a large synagogue or something there? It's just an interesting question I'm raising. Anyway, so here's this person that knew Holshas and all the rest of me. He ended up being a rabbi in Seattle for about 10 years or so. And I'll tell you again, Seattle's a very pretty city, and I could see, I myself have been two or three times to speak in Seattle, and I've asked people there myself,
You know, seems like a community to be perfect if somebody set up a yeshiva there could turn it like into a mini Baltimore, so to speak. Because what it takes in America for a community to become solid and big and all the rest is one local yeshiva, like a Near Israel type situation. But apparently it's easier said than done, because I've been in a number of communities, but Seattle State stands in my mind to be perfect for that in many ways. But whatever. And then eventually he switched to Jersey City, which is on the other side of the country, right next to New York. This is still in the 40s, late 40s, when these communities still existed. Newark, Jersey City, Patterson, whatever. These were like, what's the right word? Satellites of New York. So you live over there, but you're near New York City. And they had large Jewish communities once upon a time, before the neighborhoods changed and all that, and the riots and things of this nature. And once upon a time, these places were rocking and rolling. And when I say rocking and rolling, I'm talking about in the synagogue sense. Now, these are not big Mekomos HaTorah. I read somewhere that when Rav Aaron Cutler came to America, as you know, he landed in the West Coast. And so I think he met with Rabbi Chaim Levin. He said, why don't you come and help me join start up Lakewood or something like that. Which, again, is an example of what I'm talking about. He could have gotten in the ground operation, being one of the heads of Lakewood. But who knew which way it's going to go? Like I said, I'm raising more questions than answers because I myself don't know the answers. But these are very, as a historian, it's very, very interesting in terms of the what if. But here's somebody. Look, every name we're touching, but Ron Cutler, I mean, you know, there's nobody he didn't meet. Of course, because he was from that level of learning, you know, from the top level. And here's another side of it. If you read the tzaddik in our time, about Rav Aryeh Levin, you'll see that one of the people he got close to and was one of his biggest fans was Menachem Begin. It's always been, what's the right word? It's always been like a certain sad irony. If Rav Aryeh would have lived another 10 years, I guess he was in his 80s, but listen, Rav Yasha made 100, I think, didn't he? Rav Shach made 100, it could be. If he would have lived another 10 years, Begin would get elected prime minister in Israel. He would have given him the whole world because he worshipped Aryeh Levin. So last year, I did one of my lectures. So Lolly Friedman was nice enough to send me one of these photos that Menachem Begin, whenever he visited America, would always stop in Jersey City to, you know, spend time and pay his respects to Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Levin, because anybody who's the son of Aryeh Levin is automatically a saint, you know. It's a very the whole story of Menachem Begin and their family is just very, very remarkable. I'm remembering that I'm talking of here, because all I do is ramble. If you get that book from Yehuda Avner, was it on the prime ministers? And when Yehuda Avner was Begin's political secretary or something like that, and he said, you know, the first or second days in office, Begin is calling up somebody to raise money for yeshiva run by one of Aryeh Levin's sons and all that. And he said, what are you, a schnorr? And Begin said, no, I'm proud to do this. Happy to do it. You know, anything connected with the Aryeh Levin, I'm happy to do it. So, since Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Levin, therefore, it's a rabbi in Jersey City, I guess in the 50s and 60s. These are the years, it's sad, you know, these are the years that these communities all fell apart. They fell apart because of the different changing demographics. That's the story of America. It's quote unquote the old neighborhood. I'm going to go in Baltimore on Sunday to the old neighbors. What happened to the old neighbors? Well, same thing happened to the old neighbors of Baltimore. Happened to Jersey City, happened to Passaic, happened to Patterson, you know, all the Newark, you know, all over the place. And therefore, it's, you know, you had big communities once upon a time, and then you didn't. So again, here we have someone who's a great Gaon, all the rest of it. Was a very good speaker, too, based on what I read. I saw we did a few of his speeches. You know, you can see he's a professional orator in the sense that he knows how to take a medrash and turn it into a theme. You know, old school eloquence from the big Talmid Chacham. You got to know your chazals to be able to do that well. They have it all in this Yeshurun volume. And then I think his father passed away in 69. When he came to 69, they said, listen, you become a rabbi over here in Israel. And he took it to be in Pardes Chana. Now, I did a little bit of research on this, and I saw Rav Herzog,
when he was old and dying, he wanted Rabbi Chaim Yaakovin to be his successor as chief rabbi of Israel. Isn't that interesting? Now, that's not going to happen because you got to be politically connected and you have to be politically ruthless and play politics. And he doesn't seem to have been that sort of a person. You know, too much of an honest, clean person and too big of a Talmud Chacham to do that. But and there's other things they wanted to be a rabbi in Yerushalayim. But all I'm trying to tell you is like this. They don't offer the regular guy to be chief rabbi of Israel. They don't offer a regular rabbi to be chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. How many people, you know, like this? You have to be a Gaon Adir to get into that league. And so he spent the rest of his life, as far as I see, in Rabbi in Pardes Chana, which is, you know, one of those real Israeli communities. And, you know, I think they have all types of Jews over there. And this probably was perfect for him. I'm just guessing. Probably is perfect for him. Because in Eretz Yisrael, you don't have the kind of divisions that you have in America. You have different sorts of divisions. But in Eretz Yisrael, you have the type of... Let me put it this way. What's so unusual about the story of Ari Levin? He was... And the answer, at least to my mind, goes like this. And this, unlike father, like son. You know, we all are familiar in America, most of us, those listening to me, with the idea that in Israel you got all these Sephardim, and they're not from exactly, but they are. You know what I'm talking about. Meaning, you know, they don't necessarily observe this and that and the other, but they can. And sometimes it's the easiest thing for the world for them to come Shomer Shabbos. Maybe they'll slip out of it, maybe they'll slip back into it, but they're not really ideologically divorced from Yiddishkeit. They're just in a, what's the word, a sleeper mode, you understand? And so if the right person comes along, or Gavad Yosef, whatever, he can get them to flip over at night and become Shomer Torah Mitzvahs and all the rest of it, and they can do it. So in other words, they're not from, but they're not ideologically, what's the right word, you know, anti-from. They're not ideologically atheist or something like that. But we often contrast that with the Ashkenazim. And we say, I do it myself. They say, you know, Sephardim, that's one thing. But you get your Ashkenazi Jews in Israel, the Chilonim, bad news. They are totally divorced from anything, and they're anti, what's the name, Yair Lapid, these kind of guys in Israel, and they just have no gene. You know, they're missing a gene when it comes to feelings for Yiddishkeit. But that's actually not true. It's meaning it's more complicated. It's 50-50. Half the Ashkenazi Jews in Israel may be like that, but the other half are not. The other half are people who, if you press the right button, would become from or very respectful for from Kite and respectful for Torah and Rabbanim and that sort of thing, if approached the right way. Unfortunately, things are such in Israel that the from are turned off and make demonstrations and all the rest of it, and they've alienated a lot of the potentially, in my opinion anyway, a lot of the potentially sympathetic non-from Ashkenazim out there, which is just not a good idea in general. The reason I'm making a big deal out of this is, you think if you ever read the story of Rabbi Aryeh Levin, because he was such a big tzaddik by nature and he helped everybody all the time in all places, he had a big following among these types of non-from Ashkenazim. You see? Non-from Ashkenazim. Who, because they respected him, he helped when he helped them when they were suffering in the Irgun years and the Lehi, and because they knew that he, you know, he'd give a, you know, shirt off his back to people, and just it was righteousness, you know. They were completely turned on, and whether or not individually they kept Shabbos all the time, kept kosher all the time, is a separate issue, but they totally respected it and were prepared to. I remember reading somewhere, I can't remember where, just to give you an idea of what I'm talking about, that there's one time I went, when he was 55, but 70 years old, I think they made some parade or something like this. You know, Shalem, all the ex-Irgun guys, this is during the Ben-Gurion era when the people who weren't in the Haganah were looked down upon. And they wanted to make some kind of parade or to give him some kind of a gift. And he said to one of these guys who was super not from, he said, if you really want to give a gift, I'm not telling you you have to, but if you want to do something, make me feel good, don't smoke on Shabbos. And the guy said, I wouldn't do it for anybody else, but for you, I'll do it. And that's what I mean when I say that certain people had, certain of the Ashkenazim have their gene, the button on there. If you press the button the right way, then they can be turned on to Frumkite. 100%, 10%, 20%, but each one. It's very different than somebody, excuse me, I have a cold, somebody who's like, Beshita, like a communist or something, I guess, you know, who won't have any time for anything Jewish whatsoever. Now, Rabbi Levin was like this, and Rechav Yaakov Levin, as best as I can tell from what I read, is like that also. When he was in Pardes Chana, these places, these people know how to be Makarev, they're not from. You get it? They know how to attract them. What do I mean when I say Makarev? I'm not talking about turning somebody into Shomer Shabbos. Turning somebody into somebody as an appreciation for Yiddishkeit. And at the end of the day, with this I'll conclude because I'm already going long. At the end of the day, I want you to listen to this. The success of the yeshivas depend on a sympathetic population out there willing to, in Israel, I'm talking about, to tolerate that the yeshivas continue, the guys don't serve in the army, they're sitting and learning, and the other people say it's okay. Because if the majority of the population, which is not from, want to, they'll vote all that out. They'll say, I'm going to cut off all the money for the yeshivas. You guys have to go out and join everybody else. There's nothing special about learning more than something else. And then it'll be up the creek. Then you'll have a real crisis on your hands. The yeshivas in Israel have, the from world has depended, whether realized or not, on the at least passive goodwill of the non-from for 70 years now. Now, if you have people like Rav Aryeh Levin, Chaim Yaakov Levin, people like that, who give off the positive vibes, then the non-person from person says like this, I myself am not exactly religious, and I don't keep this and that and the other, and it's true, my son serves in the army, this one doesn't serve in the army, but it's a good thing that they're doing. You know, saying the learning of Torah is not for me, but somebody should do it. It's a good thing, and I'm willing to put up with this situation. If not, if you get people who are turned off, all they do is just, what's the right word? You know, just criticize and give off negative vibes, then you alienate. And if you alienate all the non-from, I repeat, all the non-from, then there's going to be a real crisis on the hands. So I will just end this by saying that people like Rabbi Chaim Yaakov Levin and those types are very, very much needed in Israel. In America too, but America's kind of late in the day, unfortunately. You know, the American Jewry is split across a giant chasm. We really are. But in Israel, not so much. Some, yes. I just read Haaretz, you know. But many not. And if there are more people like this, then, as I said before, you would have much less of a strain between the from and the not from. And the yeshivas would be able to do their things with the acquiescence of the others. With the acquiescence of the others. If only we lived in a world in which, you know, the non-from acknowledged the importance of the from kite, and the from acknowledged the value of the non-from. Let's put it this way. This guy may not be serving in the army, but then have appreciation for the person that is serving in the army. Which, by the way, you did see in the last war. You know, remember the Sheba guys came to dance with them and bring them pizzas and things like this. You know, if somebody says, I'm not doing it exactly, but I appreciate what you're doing, that's a giant step in achdus. And the Achdus is, at the end of the day, is what it's all about. So I hope I've done a little bit in sharing a portrait of a person that I don't think most of us knew much about. And if you're able to read Hebrew, you go into the Yeshurun. I forget which volume it is. I think it's number 30. You read, as I say before, a real story that you come across everybody who's anybody in the course of the life of this man. And as I say before, the example of a bridging between the different groups and trying to show a positive side. Bring out, let's put it this way, bring out the positive of the from towards the non-from and the non-from towards the from. That is a reason enough for people like that to be remembered. No, not remembered, imitated. Imitated. And have a good Shabbos.
For sponsorship opportunities or to support this podcast, please visit our donate page at www.support.rabbidovidkatz.com.